And we're still, like everybody else, kind of looking for answers, you know, to explain the previous leak and also this one. And then there's the issue of how they've responded. And, you know, it's been really surprising to us that they've allowed us complete access. They've been incredibly transparent with us and continue to allow me, you know, access to both the river in the area and any information that we want about, you know, what they're doing and how they plan to protect the river.
Well, David Butler, we want to thank you for being with us. Cahaba Riverkeeper traveled to the site of the Colonial Pipeline Company disaster, monitoring the environmental impacts. That does it for our show. We'll be doing a 5-hour special on election night from 7 Eastern time in the evening until midnight. We hope you tune in at democracynow.org or your station runs us. Tune in there. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Gezder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. The evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Dookie Jam, Thursday, November 3rd at 10 p.m. at Dante's in Portland. The Dookie Jam is a funk jam session that happens monthly at Dante's. Lots of funky treats for your eyes and ears, including live streaming video on Audio Globe and live streaming audio on the KBOO website. Again, that's Dookie Jam, Thursday, November 3rd at 10 p.m. at Dante's, 350 West Burnside in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll have a special live radio play, Calvin Coolidge Goes Crazy, on Thursday, November 10th at 7 p.m. This live radio play is set in 1927, expanding on to the true story of Calvin Coolidge's decision in 1927 to not run for a second term as President of the United States. It also features songs from the era by Jerome Kern, Fats Waller, Cole Porter, Rube Bloom, and more. Again, that's Calvin Coolidge Goes Crazy, Thursday, November 10th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street here in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll take a look at the accomplishments of the former director of the Community Alliance of Tenants, Justin Bury, who died yesterday.
The Oregon Humane Society has come under criticism for a culturally insensitive fundraiser.
And a new poll has found Measure 97 supporters are losing ground, but some observers have criticized the poll's methodology.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 3rd, 2016. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Robert Barncore. So today is the last day to mail in your Multnomah County ballot if you want to guarantee that it gets received before November 8th. There are still a number of locations where ballots can be dropped up until Election Day without using the U.S. mail. The Multnomah County Elections Office at 1040 Southeast Morrison Street has a 24-hour pedestrian and drive-through ballot box. This election office on 10th and Morrison is also the only place where you can get a replacement ballot if you need one. All Multnomah County libraries will have indoor ballot drop boxes during their normal operating hours. Their hours may vary, so be sure to check before you go. There are also 8 more 24-hour drop sites spread throughout the county. You can find the one nearest you by going online to multco.us/elections. Filling out and turning in your Multnomah County ballot is the only way that county residents can vote. I include this warning. There have been recent ads offering ways to text your vote. Those are misinformation. Or if they claim that you need to go to a specific location to vote, those are all pure misinformation.
Twitter finally stepped in yesterday after a fake account tweeted advertisement saying that Hillary Clinton supporters can text in their vote. It's not unusual to see campaigns anonymously releasing fake voting information to confuse potential voters, but this is a new political scam for the digital age. After initially ignoring complaints about their fake ads, which featured graphics from Clinton's campaign materials, Twitter moderators disabled the account of a tweep named the Ricky Vaughn, where many of the posts originated. This week, that same Twitter account was the source for a harassing tweet calling Clinton an obscene name starting with the letter C, which was retweeted Tuesday by Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller. Miller says it was a mistake retweet by his staff. It is not possible to vote by text anywhere in the United States.
A new poll shows the corporate tax initiative, Measure 97 here in Oregon, is losing ground. But the poll was conducted by the same firm that predicted that Hillary Clinton would win Oregon by 15 points in the primaries. Back then, Oregon Public Broadcasting helped commission the poll together with Fox News. The firm that did it, DHM, short for Davis, Hibbets, and Midgehall, says that Clinton will trounce Trump here in Oregon and that Republican Dennis Richardson is winning the Secretary of State's race over Democrat Brad Avakian. Critics of DHM's poll in the primaries focused mostly on the massive error in predicting the Clinton primary victory. A pollster with the firm publicly said the Oregon Motor Voter Law skewed those results by bringing in more voters without telephone landlines. This week's poll was also done via telephone, but the polling firm says, and I quote, "A variety of quality control measures were used, including questionnaire pretesting and validation," close quote. The other issue that drew criticism was the allegation that by putting out poll results before voting is over in Oregon, the firm could unfairly impact the outcome of the election. DHM says the margin of error for the poll is as much as 4.5%.
After the fourth rent increase in 15 months, Southeast Portland resident Jean Favini decided it was time to fight back. She contacted representatives of the Portland Tenants United, who helped her and her fellow residents of the Chestnut Court Apartments form a tenants union. Although it's still early in the process, she's hopeful that the union will give the tenants some leverage in their negotiations with the landlord. KBOO's Ray Bodwell had a chance to speak with Jean.
My understanding that your apartment complex, the Chestnut Court Apartments, has seen four rent increases in the last 15 months.
Well, you know, the place was built back in 1971 by a man named Lewis Inkster. And they're modest apartments, but nice, and in a nice neighborhood. But he wanted to build some place where that was, an affordable place for working people to live. But, Mr. Inkster is getting on in years, and his two kids, they came in, and, almost immediately the rents started going up substantially and frequently. So this last notice we got would have raised the rent four times in 15 months.
Jean, how did you get involved with Portland Tenants United?
Well, Portland Tenants United had an open meeting a couple of months ago that sounded interesting to me, so I headed to that, and I was just immediately impressed with what a wonderful group of people they are, and they're just passionate and smart and really, really dedicated to helping tenants in Portland, because we don't really have very many protections from the city or state. When things got bad here at our apartment complex, that, you know, I could reach out to them, and they have helped us enormously. And so, you know, when we would get these notices, the neighbors, we'd get together and grumble about it, of course, but those conversations always ended with, but what are we going to do? You know, who's going to help us? What, you know, they're going to do bad things to us if we complain. But the last one was just enough is enough. And since PT was there and willing to help us, we came together and we formed a tenants union.
And so what will be your activity going forward?
Well, our first thing was to notify them that we had formed the union and that we were not going to pay this rent increase because the notice they sent us was illegal. Landlords have to give you 90 days written notice to raise the rent, regardless of the amount, and they did not do that. Our next meeting is to talk about the changes that we would like to see in the complex, because we have difficulty getting repairs made, and there's just some things that we'd like to do. And we've been paying these rent increases but not getting any improvements in the apartments. And, you know, there are some things that we would like to have done. We're not demanding that we never pay any rent increases. We're just asking for them to be reasonable and not so frequent. So we are going to be meeting regularly and talking about the changes that we would like to see made, and we will continue to contact management and ask for them to work with us to preserve this place, to preserve the community that we've built here, and to preserve our security and our right to live here. We would very, very much like to work with them, and I'm hoping that they will come back and be willing to work with us as well.
For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Tonight, we mark the passing of beloved Community Alliance of Tenants activist Justin Bury. Justin stepped down last May from his job as executive director of the Renters' Rights Organization, where he started as a volunteer 7 years ago. His colleagues say that Justin helped champion historic changes in landlord-tenant law, ranging from making it illegal to discriminate against housing choice voucher recipients, to increasing the notice period for tenants living in their homes longer than a year from 30 days to 60 days, and advocating for Portland's current enhanced inspections program. Also, he led the way in leading the charge on declaring Oregon's current renters' state of emergency. This year, Justin won the Rent is Too Damn High Award from X-Ray Radio. More recently, Justin was also active in the Portland Harbor Community Coalition, focusing on Portland's chronic failure to clean up local Superfund sites. The Augustana Church in Northeast Portland is inviting all who wish to light a candle and say a prayer in honor of Justin's memory. The address of that church is 2710 Northeast 14th Avenue.
The Oregon Humane Society has come under criticism for being culturally insensitive. On Tuesday, the privately run nonprofit organization held a fundraiser called Dia de los Gatos, or Day of the Cats. The theme of the event was meant to be a play on Dia de los Muertos, a holiday celebrated in many Central and South American nations. Critics of the event have accused the Humane Society of culturally appropriating a religious holiday that is considered by its practitioners to be holy. Despite online criticism that the event was trivializing a spiritual holiday meant to celebrate the lives of deceased people, the Humane Society has stated that it was not their intention to offend anyone. The ticketed event was held on the same day that the lives of deceased infants and children are celebrated. KBOO reporter Kanan Schlesinger spoke with Oregon Humane Society spokesperson David Lytle for more.
Deceased pets are kind of like an extension of family and definitely deserve remembrance and grieving. But how do you think this feels to immigrants and people of Mexican ancestry who today are remembering and celebrating deceased children in their families?
You know, we're not intended at all to trivialize this whatsoever. That's not the intention. If people think that, I'm really sorry. I'm extend our heartfelt sympathies for that. The event is designed for people who want a memory of animals who they consider family members. Quite a few people may not have family members left. Maybe their only companion is a cat, or they just form a bond with their cat that's very deep and personal, and that's a sincere emotional bond, and they want to honor the memory of those animals. I have pictures up on my wall of cats in my life who have passed on. And to be able to reflect on their memory is a good thing for them and a good thing for me. And I hope that doesn't dishonor anyone else. I know they're not as important as people. They can never replace people in our lives, but they do fill a meaningful role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I definitely understand that role and honoring that and even creating an event to honor it. But how do you, the Humane Society, justify to the Mexican-American community and the Mexican community using a holiday that has a spiritual significance. Did you consult anyone from that community before creating the event and the theme of it?
You know, the event is not meant to trivialize or dishonor anyone. It's an event, as I said, meant to honor animals in our lives and to have fun and remember them and hopefully make life better for future animals in our lives. And if people take offense at that, I'm sorry, I'm heartfelt, sincerest apologies go out for that. But I think if they look at the nature of the event and see how it's planned and what the activity is, they may not quite feel that bad. They might think this is a good way we can honor some people that have been in our lives, some animals that have been in our lives, and pave the way for better treatment of animals. It's all about compassion and caring. That's what the Oregon Humane Society stands for.
And does the Humane Society have an equity policy? I'm just curious.
We have many policies in our human resources guidance that do require us to be absolutely non-discriminatory, to honor people's religions, if that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, just I guess I'm curious about like the policies in place to provide opportunities to marginalized groups, people from marginalized backgrounds, people of color, people of religions that are persecuted in this country, just to give them extra opportunities. I was wondering if there's anything maybe like written into the policy of the Humane Society.
I don't know off the top of my head. I do not know. The issue is not... I don't know. I'd have to research that more.
Well, that's pretty much all I wanted to ask, David. I thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and I do want to say, too, that, you know, we've had people post on our Facebook page to bring up these issues, and we've responded to them on the Facebook page, and hopefully we haven't been trying to duck or hide any issues. Mm-hmm. Very upfront about what we're doing and trying to help people understand and respond to their concerns.
Sure. And the Humane Society is like a very well-regarded organization as far as I'm aware. And I think that's part of where some of the outrage comes from. I mean, certainly you and others involved in this campaign or representing the Humane Society can understand where these offenses are coming from.
I can see how people, who would see that on the surface. I can sympathize with them, certainly. I'm just hoping that if they look more closely at the event, they'll understand what the purpose is. And that if they see it in that spirit, they'll have a different attitude. But, you know, of course, everyone has their own opinions, and I never would say you're not entitled to your own considerations and opinions. Of course not. We're all here to have them and discuss them and see what we can work out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like some people are feeling hurt and injured by the event, regardless of where they're able to get emotionally or intellectually with the event. But thanks again, David. I really appreciate you taking out the time, and I realize that these are not easy questions to answer. So very appreciated.
Thank you for giving the consideration, and have a nice day.
With KBOO News, I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
The University of Oregon law professor, who's in hot water after wearing blackface at a Halloween party last week, has been identified as the school's former diversity committee chairwoman. The university is not naming the professor, but she's been identified as Nancy Schurz. The school president, Michael Schill, this week sent out an email confirming the incident happened and that the professor is being investigated. The Oregonian newspaper reports that Schurz was paid almost $165,000 in salaries for teaching tax policy and estate planning at the university last school year. In September, the university stripped the names from two buildings on its Eugene campus that had been named after members of the Ku Klux Klan. Those names were Matthew Deedy and Frederick Dunn. In addressing the law professor in blackface, the university says it's referring the investigation to the Office of Affirmative Action and Equal Opportunity, and that office will decide whether the professor violated any laws. Meanwhile, Professor Schurz is on paid administrative leave.
For the past 20 years, low-income members of Pacific Island nations have been barred from receiving health insurance assistance. Oregon became the first state to change that this year. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has this story from the Oregon News Service.
Open enrollment for health care plans has begun, and for the first time in two decades, low-income Pacific Islanders in Oregon are eligible for coverage as well. Earlier this year, low-income citizens of the Compact of Free Association, or COFA, nations of Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, and Palau gained health coverage under the COFA Healthcare Premium Assistance Program, passed unanimously by Oregon lawmakers. Welfare reform in 1996 had barred COFA citizens from health services such as Medicaid. Joe Enlett with the Health Equity Initiative says the new legislation is the first of its kind in the nation.
Oregon is the only one that actually has a premium assistance program that not only covers premiums, but it also helps to pay for co-pays and pays for medication as well. So Oregon is breaking new ground.
Events are planned throughout the open enrollment period to help eligible COFA citizens in Oregon enroll in a health plan, including an event today, Thursday, at Northwest Family Services in Portland from noon until 6 p.m. Oregon has the third largest COFA population in the nation. The COFA Alliance National Network, or CAN, and the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, or APANO, introduced and worked to pass the Premium Assistance Bill. David Anatok is a lead community organizer for CAN, which is hosting 13 events across the state to help people sign up for the program. He says before the bill was passed, members of the community had few health care options, often relying on checkups at free clinics before being referred somewhere else.
They get referred to an emergency service, which is the only service, again, they're eligible for. And based on the case, there's been folks that have been in the emergency and ranged up a couple thousand dollars up to $50,000 bills and unable to pay for it.
Residents of COFA countries are allowed to live and work in the United States because of the military testing of nuclear weapons near their home islands during the Cold War. Enlett says Oregon lawmakers felt they were righting a historical wrong with this program.
But to me, the bigger victory is actually that we are heard, that people are not invisible, that there's somebody, and that people are beginning to see and hear our story.
For KBOO Evening News, in collaboration with the Oregon News Service, I'm Sam Bowman.
Cybersecurity expert and Transportation Safety Administration critic Bruce Schneer says the internet meltdown last month was no accident. KBOO's Al Khan reports.
Several major websites were disrupted on October 21st, including Amazon, PayPal, Twitter, and Netflix. According to internet security expert Bruce Schneier, this was no accident, and someone is learning to take down the internet. Observers say if successful, attacks on companies such as these could cause a global blackout to all websites and email addresses in the most top-level domains. Schneier feels that based on the strength and complexity of these attacks, that they may be coming from a nation's military cyber command, similar to the high-level spy plane flights during the Cold War. Schneier wrote on his blog, Schneier Blog, at Twitter, that the easiest way to take a network off the internet is with a distributed denial-of-service attack, which means blasting a site with an overwhelming amount of data. This type of attack has been used many times by hackers and by criminals as a means of extortion. DYN, which is a company that manages website domains and routes internet traffic, came under attack at 7 a.m. and seemed to have everything resolved within a few hours. But issues persisted, and by late Friday afternoon, DYN said it was investigating a third attack. Another company, which is a registrar for many popular websites, VeriSign, also came under attack on Friday. The FBI said it was investigating all possible causes for these attacks. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring conversations around organizing in the Black African community in the Portland area. Tomorrow's weather will be clear during the day, with a high of 66 and a low of 58, with a 70% chance of rain at night. Today in history, in 1979, five people were killed during a Death to the Klan rally held in Communist Workers' Party in Greensboro, North Carolina. A march of black and white residents was fired upon by members of the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party. Several Klansmen and Nazis were tried in separate state and federal trials, receiving full acquittals from all white juries. A civil suit the next year determined that the local police allowed the violence to go forward even after hearing of the killer's plans from an informant. And in 1957, Russia launched Sputnik 2 into space, containing a stray dog from Moscow named Laika. The quote of the day is from Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy. The two most powerful warriors are patience and time.
Well, it's about 25 minutes after 5 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Wreck of the Old 97 is a country ballad telling what happens when a highballing engineer pushes a train's throttle too hard, going too far, too fast. Old 97 jumped the tracks, and the engineer, well, as the song puts it, he was found in the wreck with his hands on the throttle, scalded to death by the steam. This was written about a North Carolina train disaster in 1903, but it could have been written this year about an even bigger disaster called the wreck of Wells Fargo. The engineer, CEO John Stumpf, pushed the profit throttle way too hard, relentlessly demanding that employees in its 6,000 branch banks use high-pressure tactics and outright deceit to open multiple accounts that customers didn't need or even know about, forcing them to pay more fees. Wells Fargo branches were even called stores to emphasize sales over service. For a while, it worked. Profits zoomed, as did Stumpf's multimillion dollar paychecks, and he was named 2013's Banker of the Year. But Wells Fargo went off the tracks this summer when it became public that the bank was a financial predator, bilking old people who have memory problems and immigrants who couldn't understand much English. The stock price plummeted. Congress opened hearings, prosecutors launched investigations, and they found Stumpf in the wreckage with his hand on the throttle, his job fading away, and his personal reputation scalded to death by public outrage. But this ballad is about more than one overreaching CEO in an out-of-control bank. It's a dirge for the irrational idea that today's corporate system can be self-governing. A system consisting of too-big-to-manage giantism, propelled by an executive suite ethic of greed, overseen by a rickety structure of insider board members. This is Jim Hightower saying, the system itself is the wreck, a wreck that keeps happening.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The future of Oregon is at stake in this election, and I couldn't be prouder of the work that the Oregon Education Association and the educators in this state have done to step up and cause that movement that can make a difference for our students and build the schools that they deserve. So thank you to each and every one of those educators and each and every one of those advocates who has joined us with this opportunity to build the Oregon that we all deserve.
Oregon Education Association President Hannah Vandering talking about Measure 97 on the November 8th ballot. It would tax big corporations with at least $25 million in Oregon sales, generating $3 billion a year to stabilize education and senior health care funding. But big business is pouring millions of dollars into the fight to defeat it.
It's just really disheartening that the business community here in Oregon is fighting so hard against something that will make such a difference for our students, seniors, and everyday Oregonians. It's time they pay their fair share. It's time that everyday Oregonians not have to flip the bill for everything that we have while businesses come in and make huge profits off their sales here in Oregon.
The Indiana University Kelley School of Business has found that when workers have little or no control over their high-stress jobs, they are more likely to die. The study is called Worked to Death: The Relationships of Job Demands and Job Control with Mortality. It found that combining a high-stress job with no power over the work results in a 15.4% increase in the likelihood of death. And it's not just the stress of work. It's the power or control workers have over their own work lives. High-stress jobs with no worker control creates a higher risk of death. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, will picket airports in Orlando, Chicago, and Denver Thursday. They're protesting a delay in reaching a new labor contract at Frontier Airlines. Negotiations started more than a year ago. AFA-CWA says Frontier must invest in its people to ensure the future success of the airline. Frontier says it will hire 800 flight attendants and 300 pilots by the end of next year.
Brought to you by the California Teachers Association, 325,000 educators who know quality public schools make a better California for all of us. Information on how California teachers are shaping a stronger future for our kids is online at cta.org. Brought to you in part by the Alliance for American Manufacturing, working to build coalitions between business, labor, legislators, and activists. Information about our mission to strengthen American manufacturing and rebuild the middle class through smart public policy is available online at AmericanManufacturing.org.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit LaborRadio.org.
As California prepares to vote on legalizing recreational marijuana, the state's thriving medical marijuana industry is scrambling to prepare for the impending change. In Los Angeles, less than 150 of the city's hundreds and hundreds of dispensaries are officially recognized by the local government. Legislation being written now will determine what the city's medical marijuana industry will look like after November, and a battle is brewing between licensed and unlicensed business owners over who should write that legislation and what it should say. Carla Green of Free Speech Radio News reports from Los Angeles.
Dozens of people crowd into a room on the third floor of City Hall in Los Angeles. They fill rows and rows of benches, some wearing suits and ties, others wearing bright blue shirts with orange writing that reads, Southern California Coalition. A man in a suit steps up to a microphone at the front of the room.
I've been coming here for 10 years.
Carlos De La Torre is a marijuana dispensary owner and an executive board member of the United Cannabis Business Alliance, or the UCBA. He was at the council committee meeting to speak in favor of a contentious ballot initiative to license marijuana businesses, a ballot initiative that was written by the UCBA. Over the past 10 years, Los Angeles has effectively had a tiered system for marijuana dispensaries. Hundreds of dispensaries operate in the city, but only about 135 of them are officially registered. And even those 135 or so dispensaries exist in a kind of legal gray zone. They have something called limited immunity from prosecution. The rest have no protection at all. And that number, 135, it's an arbitrary one. It's just the number of dispensaries that are still open now and that managed to fill out the paperwork in time back in 2007 when the limited immunity system was set up. Now, under statewide regulations passed last year, medical marijuana businesses will have to register at both the state and local level to get actual licenses, not just limited immunity and recognition from the city. Just what that regulatory system should look like is what everyone is so worked up about. At the meeting, one after another, speakers in blue shirts start to line up at the microphone to lay out their opposition to the UCBA's ordinance. This is Yami Bolanos. She's a dispensary owner and founder of a medical marijuana trade organization. Like De La Torre, Bolanos' dispensary is one of the 135 with limited immunity. She would get priority for licensing under the UCBA's ballot initiative, but she's against it anyway. She says it makes it unnecessarily difficult for businesses that don't already have limited immunity to get licenses, licenses that could be for medical or recreational marijuana businesses, if the vote on Election Day comes down in favor of legalizing recreational marijuana.
The edible makers, the manufacturers, if they're already here and they're already producing and they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, then they should be able to step up to get a license.
She also takes issue with another provision in the UCBA initiative, one that says there must always be a manager on site who hasn't been convicted of a drug-related felony in the past 10 years. Lots of people who've been in the medical marijuana industry for a while have drug-related felonies, Bolano says.
That's not fair. How can you exclude the people that paid the dues for the rest of us? Because if you have a conviction, that means you got caught. And how can you exclude those people? You can't.
Especially because decades of drug war policies have shown that African Americans and Latinos are far more likely than whites to be convicted of drug-related crimes, even though drug use is more or less equal across the demographic groups. And as the state prepares to vote on legalizing marijuana for recreational use, felony-related restrictions like the UCBA's could end up excluding some people from a potentially lucrative new legal industry. Kat Packer works at the Drug Policy Alliance in Los Angeles, and she says the DPA opposes the ballot ordinance for many of the same reasons Bolanos does. It's exclusionary, unnecessarily so, she says, like the felony provision.
So when we're saying that we're targeting communities of color for drug offenses, specifically for marijuana, any type of additional barrier, really would codify racial discrimination.
De La Torre says the ballot initiative language is meant to open up licensing opportunities to more than just 135 dispensaries. But he does think that those who are registered with the city and have been following the rules should get priority for licenses under the new system.
I find it quite curious that a lot of these other dispensaries who, quite frankly, don't pay any of their taxes, I can't say that all of them, but we all know that this industry has, been overwrought with a proliferation of rogue, is what the city calls them, rogue dispensaries. So how do you work from there? Like, how does the city grant some kind of a license? How does the city reward someone for their bad behavior?
He says the UCBA wrote its ordinance just to get something on the ballot. If people don't like the UCBA's ordinance, they should write their own, he says. And it looks like that's exactly what's happening. At a meeting this week, the Los Angeles City Council voted to put its own marijuana regulation initiative on the March 2017 ballot, right alongside the UCBA's. Carla Green, FSRN, Los Angeles.
In the final week of the 2016 presidential election, the race is still too close to call and will come down to voter turnout in just a few swing states. FSRN's Sean Canaan reports in the largest battleground state, Florida. A major influx of new voters from Puerto Rico could tilt the election.
Florida's 29 electoral votes are still up for grabs. Polls this week show the race between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in a virtual tie in the state. North Florida traditionally votes for Republicans in presidential races, and South Florida typically goes for Democrats. The tipping point of the state is usually Central Florida. The I-4 corridor that stretches from the Gulf of Mexico and Tampa Bay through Orlando and Kissimmee and onto the Atlantic Ocean. In parts of Central Florida, the number of Latino voters is growing. Victor DeMaio is treasurer of the Hillsborough County Democratic Hispanic Caucus of Florida and used to do outreach work for the U.S. Census. He says Latinos now make up one-fifth of Floridians.
That's a new development that came as a result of the huge Puerto Rican area in Central Florida. So when they say that we are here literally in ground zero of the next presidential election, you cannot ignore the fact that so many Hispanics are going to vote. Tampa, Hillsborough County, West Central Florida, all the way through Orlando, there's been an exponential growth of Hispanics, and they're going to make a huge difference in this election.
Historically, Cubans were the largest and most politically important group of Latinos in the state, but that's changing in part because of the lure of employment in the tourism sector near Walt Disney World.
The largest other group in here in Florida are really Puerto Ricans, because Puerto Rico, being a commonwealth of the United States, Puerto Ricans automatically are considered U.S. citizens, in a sense, because they can vote in our presidential elections.
This is the first election since the most recent congressional redistricting, and DeMaio says it's the first time a Hispanic majority district has been carved out in Florida. State Senator Darren Soto is the Democratic nominee for Congress in that district.
In the Puerto Rican community in Central Florida, we've grown to over 500,000, being the majority of Hispanics in Central Florida, fostered by huge growth from my fellow New Yorkans in the tri-state area, folks who were raised in New York or born in New York, New Jersey, as well as those from the island coming in. And Tampa Bay is actually the second largest population with regard to Puerto Rican communities in the state. So we've gone from being only a few thousand to well over 1 million, with many of us concentrated here in Central Florida.
Because of these migrations, Soto says Puerto Ricans and other Latinos are reshaping the demographics and voting trends in Florida.
We Hispanics, our voting is up from 2012, driven in part by having several Hispanics, including myself, on the ballot, in part because of the offensive statements made by Donald Trump, and in part by the fact that we simply have larger numbers. Because of the economic crisis on the island, a lot of folks have moved to Central Florida, and they're making their voice heard for the first time.
Civic organizations working to turn out the Latino vote are amplifying those voices. Esteban Garces is Florida director of Mi Familia Vota, a nonpartisan group active in six states, including three swing states, Colorado, Nevada, and Florida. He says they've registered 34,000 Hispanics to vote this year.
Latinos here in Central Florida, along the I-4 corridor, including Tampa, will decide who the next president is. The I-4 corridor has seen a tremendous growth from 4.1 million residents to 4.4 million residents from 2008 to 2013, and 60% of that growth has been Latino.
Garces says many of those new arrivals are Puerto Ricans who are U.S. citizens and are immediately eligible to vote. Another community organizer is Jose Palacios with the Florida Immigrant Coalition in Tampa. Because his group is a nonprofit, he wouldn't weigh in when asked if more Latinos will support Hillary Clinton in the election. But polls indicate the Democrat has a large edge among Hispanic voters.
Because we've knocked on over 85,000 doors, we've had over 5,000 phone calls, and people are confirming that they've already came out to vote.
With the two leading candidates neck and neck as the finish line looms, it's still unclear if the Central Florida Puerto Rican population will spur a winner to the tape. But a poll out this week from the National Association of Latino Elected Officials gives Clinton a 74-14% edge over Donald Trump among Latino voters across the nation. Sean Canaan, FSRN, Tampa.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imc.org for Thursday, November 3rd, 2016. Ma'an Abu Qara'a, 23, was killed on Thursday evening after soldiers shot him at a bus stop near the illegal Israeli settlement of Ofer, north of the central West Bank city of Ramallah. Abu Qara'a is from the village of Al-Mazra'a Al-Gharbiya near Ramallah. He was seen on the ground bleeding while Israeli troops did not provide him with medical care or allow Palestinian medics to reach him, local sources reported. Up until the time of this report, the circumstances of his death remains unknown. On Thursday midday, Palestinian medical sources announced that Raed Hijje, 38, died of wounds he sustained during the 2002 Israeli invasion targeting the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Hijje was shot by Israeli army gunfire in his head and hand. In addition, he inhaled high toxic gas, which led to him losing his ability to walk and talk, and was admitted to Nablus Hospital until he was pronounced dead on Thursday, medical sources reported. Staying in Nablus, a teenage female student was injured in the head. Many others were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation when Israeli troops attacked school students on their way home on midday Thursday. Clashes erupted between the invading troops and students. Arij Rabia, 15, was moved to Nablus City Hospital after sustaining light wounds. Moreover, the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, has reported that Israeli soldiers have kidnapped overnight and at dawn on Thursday 24 Palestinians, including 8 family members and a journalist, in different parts of the occupied West Bank. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, November 3rd, 2016, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Barmoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer produce newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Khan, Ray Bodwell, Kanan Schlesinger, and Jenna Yokoyama. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, on 104.3 FM and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Robert Barncore. Coming up tomorrow morning, Friday, November the 4th, at 7 o'clock, it'll be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Linda Olson-Osterlund takes your calls to talk about next week's election. At 9, on Water World, we'll hear about water and politics in Pakistan from Fahim Zakhar Khan, the former mayor of Karachi. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, news, and commentary. And at 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, tune in for a Radio Geekly. It'll be interviews with Black Nerd Problems, with Feminist Frequency, and Lone, that's L-O-N-E, Shark Games. Plus, you'll learn about the local charity Pretty Awesome Gamers, and more besides that. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Jeremy Scale delivers the Between the Lines 25th anniversary celebration speech about election 2016 and about U.S. foreign policy. It was recorded on October 8th at the United Church on the Green in New Haven, Connecticut.
You know, we could spend an entire 90 minutes talking about the dangers of a Trump presidency, although with this latest leak of this video, with him saying these incredibly misogynistic, sexist things, but more important than that, bragging about his intent to commit sexual assault. It's not sexual abuse. It's not sexual harassment. What Trump bragged about was his intent and his ability to sexually assault women. And so when you read people